recommendation engines based on location?
Yeah. So just to reiterate the hack day, those hack days are really, I think, a pretty interesting thing that's happening that may really help expand this sort of future of music discovery, where developers really are bringing their passion and their expertise to building apps that are help people find new music. And I think, you know, the thing about locale that Matthew was talking about, I think is really important, not just for showing charts, but for trying to get the experience that TJ is trying to get, where you have that one button interface to play me music that I like. If you happen to be seeding a playlist but with Adele, but you happen to live in Brazil, the mix of local artists that you mix into that playlist are going to be very different than if you happen to live in New York City. So I think that type of information is going to be key for any kind of discovery or playlisting app.
It makes it a serendipitous experience for the user, too, because you're able to surface deeper catalog artists that are local that are still known to the user in ways that you can't do it across an entire user base. So I'm originally from Minneapolis, and having a Minneapolis band show up because it's similar, which we wouldn't normally surface for somebody that has, you know, from Austin, is a pretty incredible serendipity. And I think it drives engagement significantly.
Yeah. I think one of the other things that is required is new interface ideas for ways to access the music. We were all talking in the panel. We've all been working quite a bit with Mood. We think experiential access to music. Like, in other words, you have you're picking an artist, you say, I want Zen Garden, you know, what is that, you know? And well, maybe all of you have a different idea what that might be, but the idea that basically people are in a certain mood and they're feeling a certain thing and they're looking for music that fits that mood is actually becoming something that a lot of people are putting. And actually in the automobile where we are, this is the interface they're putting in the car, because you can't actually look at the artist names in a list. So you have to do almost all of it, just like he's saying, TJ's saying, it has to be automatic, or you have to provide them with something that's experiential but doesn't require them to look at a scrolling list of names. And so cars are really challenging getting that done, and Mood is something that we've been working on that's going pretty well.
Yeah, and Mood must be like one of the hardest things to work on. I mean, it's so...
It's entirely subjective.
Yeah, well, that's why we often use tags to do that, right? The tagging piece of it is like, you know, you could have multiple tags to be able to do that, and sometimes they're going to be good. Sometimes, as Paul points out, there's a little bit of a tag war over something.
Yeah, so you mentioned there was the going to sleep tag. So tell me no one has ever spammed that.
So, yeah, and what's good about the spamming part of that is that because we have so many things, it just falls to the bottom and it doesn't come up very frequently. Mm-hmm. But it is one of those things that we notice that you know, tagging helps a little bit, but better still is users telling us what they like and using their personal tags to steer something.
Right.
So personal tagging and global tags are a really good way for people to do this. We just need to make it easier, because I don't think every user wants to tag every bit of piece of music. We'd all get bored really fast with that. So,
right.
Things
but
like
thank
this.
Goodness for those, you know.
Yeah, the hyper.
We have an art thing too. Users who do that.
And you trust them, right? This is where the social does have value, right? Is the people you do trust. I'm a little bit of a skeptic about social recommendation. I don't know that my Facebook feed is a really great way to get my music recommendations. And I would guarantee you most people in this have had that experience with your boss who likes smooth jazz starts having stuff into your feed, and your mom who likes Lawrence Welk starts showing up. You just, you know, that's not a great overlap. But I think you find those people you do have passion about, and you start following their world. I think there's some advantage there.
Yeah. So the social tags, I think, that Last.fm has been collecting is really an amazing data set of context and social culture around music. And so there's actually quite a bit of research in the academic music information retrieval community to see if people can predict social tags for new music just based on the audio. So
yeah.
There's this data set called the Million Song Data Set, which a number of companies have contributed to, including Echonest. We've contributed a lot of audio attributes. Last.fm is contributed an incredible amount of social tags. So this is like the perfect research venue to say, you can go to songs that have already been tagged, let's say chill. And there's people who understand machine learning and signal processing who can build models for what is the quintessential chill song. And it, when new music comes up, they can then automatically apply at least a dozen Last.fm-like tags to songs that have never been actually listened to by a human before.
Yeah. And so this tag extrapolation, as it were.
Yeah, so let's deal with this cold start problem, because you know, even though Last.fm has all these great tags, a brand new song by a brand new artist won't have any context around it. And so that never makes it into the system, and you get this horrible anti-feedback loop where the new stuff doesn't make it in. So this is a way to deal with that sort of problem.
Yeah. And TJ, how do you value social? I mean, for you, it's a really important thing, because at Mog, they actually gather a number of different data sets from different companies, you know, including Last.fm and others. And they also add their own layer of, like, you know, they mix the ingredients in a way that makes their recommendation unique and also bring in the social element into it. So how does social stack up against the recommendations from algorithms? And is maybe the value of the social feed of the person that is actually plugging into it more valuable than their friends' recommendations?
So there's a caveat here. It depends on demographic.
Yeah.
So younger people tend to cluster around genres of music with their friends. And so we see a much higher click-through on social recommendations in the 18 to 24. As the demographic gets older, it becomes less useful. In fact, it becomes almost not useful at all. We really rely on social on ingress, so coming into the service. So Facebook, we instantly personalize. We grab your music likes,
yeah, really,
and we can make the interface familiar. We can show you stuff that you know. We're experimenting with social, and social is important with music. I think it's not necessarily because people like to listen to music together, but I think it's such an important part of people's lifestyle that they want to badge themselves with what they're listening to,
right,
unless they don't, which when they want to hide their listens. But I think that the personalization is really key, because music is a deeply personal thing. If we could get social to the point where it was like those conversations we've all had when you go out and you have a beer with a friend, and he says, "This, you've really got to hear this, and this is why," that would be great. But right now, social as it's implemented and as we can harvest and as we can integrate is really at a much higher level.
Cool.
Not great.
Good question.
Yeah. My name's Julian Funk. I'm an independent artist from New York. What about the inverse of leveraging, say, my fans and that like me and checking out their demographics? Do you guys have plans to do that?
You mean driving your fans?
No, I mean like checking out who are my fans. Say I have 10,000 fans and they're, you know, girls that are 18 to 24.
That'd be good. That'd be really good.
You know what I mean, though,
yeah,
right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I can say one thing about this. There are some artists that have, I mean, millions of fans have realized that when you friend them, they have access to their, you know, to all of their information.
Yeah.
And people are building tools to actually, up to now, a lot of these guys didn't realize what they really had access to. They can send them all a message, and that's what they've been doing a lot to. But they actually can harvest their taste. And some artists have been thinking about using that to help spot other artists they might want to put on their own sub-labels and things like that.
Yeah.
So it is very interesting, and especially if a guy has 7 million fans, that's an insane amount of user data.
And we do track through listens. We actually do identify your top fans on a Last.fm page, and we've always been really wary of making that direct connection the way Facebook has, right? Because we've always wanted to be a pretty clean service where we didn't just have people just sending out new offers to people. But over the course of this year, we're trying to fix that artist and fan relationship more clearly, right? They want to hear from you, and vice versa. What's the right, less noisy, non-spammy way for you guys to have a conversation?
I mean, if you're one of those guys, you could make a, you know, fan map that would run in real time. You can see every, I mean,
yeah,
the data is insane. Every location, every play, you know, every like. I mean,
did you take my data and then send it to new people?
Not unless you gave it to us. That's the problem. You have your data. I can't get in there.
We do it to a certain extent. I mean, the sense that this is sort of where the listening data comes into effect, right? When we take your fans and we put you next to similar artists, that's a big part of the similar artist algorithm, right? So you find clusters like labels used to do, where they would put similar, and some of the smaller labels still do. You can tell from your community has a circle of you plus the next circle around you of fans who are a lot like you, and that definitely influences all of our algorithms, right? And that's where the listening data starts to affect quite a bit.
Yeah, and one of the main problems as well for artists that are in the room, you know, is monetizing on the streams as well, and making themselves known in a world of like 15, 16, 17 million tracks and growing. So all of you guys are working to make that process easier. You know, TJ was talking about how a lot of the, most of the tracks on Mog have been played at least once nowadays. And that's great, because it means that as the income streams grow from streaming services, then, you know, if the long tail becomes a little bit more exposed, then independent artists can actually start making a bit more money. And you guys are doing a lot of work as well at Last.fm on giving more power to the independents.
We focus on them, and that's actually, I think, a difference between a lot of these, is that that's really where our core of our community is around, is about emerging artists. Right?
Yeah.
That's, I think, what people come to Last.fm for. So a big piece of that, about a fifth of our radio plays are from independent unsigned artists. If you upload your music into Last.fm, we put you on our radio, and we try to filter you in based on your listening habits and your other people to find the right match for you. We don't just slam dubstep guys in with the heavy metal guys, because that's not going to work, right? We try to use the taste to help you find those new artists.
But that's
an active thing we really promote heavily.
I think it's a critical thing. We were talking about this a little bit before, that mixing in new artists properly into these systems and actually focusing on that is almost a societal duty, and it's also a challenge. Like you're saying, you have what we were saying, the listeners who need to hear the next Bon Jovi recording because that's what they're into and they can only handle that. We have to kind of retrain these people, unfortunately, from a world that, in fact, became a hits-driven, big artist world. Now we don't have that limitation anymore, but that means we have to get people to open their ears and actually, like, you know, be tolerant of actual new things, and that actually requires, I think they will like it, but it does require some, large societal retraining.
And context, right? I mean,
I think the
thing that we put into our algorithms is to say, we're recommending this to you because of this, right? Because you listen to this track. Paul talked about this earlier in the prep. Like, you also want to recommend stuff that they forgot they loved, right? This is, you've listened to this album, but not this one, right? You've experienced this artist, but you forgot this was fantastic. Your example of Led Zeppelin was great. So.
And we launched initially our personalized content as lists without the context. And we had lots of interactions with our users where they said, you're wrong.
Yeah.
And once we showed them the context, the satisfaction level went super high. And they're like, now I understand.
Yeah, you can't have recommendations without them and understanding what's driving that. It goes, makes them crazy.
Yeah.
They try to imagine all kinds of things, and it infuriates them, actually.
Yep.
Yeah. And how do you... Sure. Question?
Track with the emerging artists. While a lot of artists might be in a single genre, there's also a lot of artists that cross genres all the time from one track to the next. So following up on the theme of track level identification, emerging artists, I mean, it becomes really critical about where you place that artist when they first enter your data set. How do you, especially for the artist has a wide band of different genres represented?
Yeah, so we in our system have this thing called a correlate system. So what we actually do is, and this is kind of an interesting thing, and iTunes does not really use this, but should probably. Basically, you know, if you have a specific genre, there are other very closely related genres. So if you had something that was, you know, folk music, there's some folk rock that actually fits in that, and there's some other kinds of folk that fit in that. And which ones are those? And which would go to his tags? And we've actually built a global map of trying to pull all these things together in a weighted way so that we can actually have the users and their tags bring the tracks together. So when you make a playlist, you get a mixture of stuff from a little bit broader set than any things are just labeled rock or whatever it is. And he probably does this with the multiple tags. But the reality is that's such a critical thing because artists don't stay, well, many
we
artists
we hope they don't.
Yeah. They hope they stay in a single, I mean, like a single narrow genre. But I do think that getting the data in there right at the beginning and then having a system that pulls that together is critical. And these are like all under the hood things, but it's critical. I mean, it's critical because otherwise you won't get an interesting selection of music. That's really what you're after.
And this ties directly into the listener's mood. So if there's oftentimes where a user just wants to hit shuffle on their iPod. They want to hear everything they know, and they want to hear it mixed up. And then there's the kind of college radio experience where you kind of want to move a little bit to the right and have some stuff that you don't know brought in. And it could be eclectic. And we have these interface UIs that we've been playing with. The one we have in our current player moves you from an artist-only radio where it plays only one artist to a mix of similar artists, like a Pandora-style radio. We've been experimenting with stuff I know and stuff I don't know. And that as you drag it from one side to another, it gets more eclectic and yep. drives more discovery.
Yeah, we have exactly that concept. We will play you things you've only played before. That's your library. And we have a thing that's recommended that you've never heard before. This will let you listen to whatever. It's funny to see how you expose that in the user experience. That's really one of the challenges for all of us, I think, is that music recommendation is fun. We all want to do it. We want more people to explore new artists, especially the new stuff that's coming out. And something that Paul said before, and we just don't have the interfaces to do it as well yet, right?
Or the controls.
Yeah, we have a window that gets you this many things on the iTunes front page, right? The 12 boxes on the front page that when I work for labels, we all fought to get there because that was the ones who sold the most.
Right.
And that's really a shame. And this discovery and streaming services is that are much bigger, and there's a lot more music in all those categories. So how do we get people?
The average person knows 20 artists.
Yeah.
20. So that's why Pandora actually works, because they pipe in Bon Jovi and then they get stuff that they didn't know.
Yeah,
the reality is that whole playlisting function is a very interesting thing, and the state of the art right now for playlisting is to actually think of playlisting like a musical performance, where you start out big and then you go soft and then you go to something they know and then you go big again, and it's a journey. And it's not just like if you had these sonic attributes, like we don't want to play 20 songs that sound exactly the same in a row, you'll pass out. You know, like you can't do that. So these kind of subtleties up until recently were only really done by handmade playlists. But there's a small number of people who can really spend all the time to do that. But the new machine playlist generating things are very sophisticated, take into account mood, and do actually perform for you. That's really what they're doing. What's not there is the controls to let you, while it's performing, control it. And we were talking the break, maybe in the future there'll be gestures or other things you'll do. You'll be waving around like this and you'll be performing with the playlisting thing that's performing with you.
You got a question?
What sort of advice would you give to emerging artists to make a more successful experience on your site, like tagging advice?
Tag your files and get it in there and get your data right.
Yeah.
And get it broadly into all the services as you can. Like, figure out how stuff gets into these services and get it on there.
Yeah, and CJ was also talking about
CD Baby.
Yeah, CD Baby and the work you do with those guys.
So we work with TuneCore and CD Baby, and we'll take anything, and it'll be in our service within a week. And we'll hand it off to the Echo Nest, and they'll do a DSP scan and tell us all about the attributes, and it'll start flowing in our system. And I think that another great way to get recognized by Echo Nest is to get it written by about as
That's
well.
Right.
Have a web presence.
Yeah,
blogs.
So definitely having a web presence. So if you have a MySpace page or an equivalent out there, if there are people who have written about your music, we'll find that just automatically in our crawl. So once we know about you from partners like Mog or just serendipitous discovering you on the web, then we'll all that data will start to flow.
What about mistakes? What are the worst things you can do?
Well, the worst thing we ever had was we had Mariah Carey, who had in her contract that she was unclassifiable, classify herself with a zero, which meant she was never recommended for a while. And we had to fix that eventually.
And there are artists who try to game the system and say, you know, I sound just like YouTube and the Beatles and Radiohead.
Because they're the popular artists.
Yeah, and there's so many.
There's a lot, we were talking, there's a lot of people trying to game the tags and game the system, gain our data.
Yeah, the best thing is just to be as honest as you can about what your music's like, and then you will actually be associated with to the listeners who are more likely to actually like your stuff.
We also make a lot of gig recommendations, which I think live is another important part for us increasingly, and who they play with and who their connections are is actually something we're trying to figure out in addition to some machine tagging like Paul does at SFM. We're starting to use those connections. Like, these guys played together. These are all things that I think is great data. And so find your community, right? I mean, that's not to say you should go out and, but it's what, like I said, record labels used to do this. I'm going to the Barsic thing tonight. I'm excited to go see Barsic Records. And I know everybody on that panel is going to be on that list showcased tonight is someone I want to see because they're in the zone for me. Finding your community, touring with them, supporting each other, talking about each other in your social streams helps people to contextualize you. And that helps us to find you as people start to play them together and just start
sit in with each other because the photos that people pay attention to on Facebook are when something unusual happens. Everyone has 100 million photos of their favorite band playing on a stage. But when one guy from one band sits in with another band, that's a unique event. And it's musicians love doing it, and it's do it. And then you get a great photo, and then you get to access their user base in a sense, and they find out about you, and your user base finds out about them. So it's an incredible tool.
It's most of our Scrabble data also comes from non-streaming services. So if it's hard to get onto a streaming service, and this isn't just a plug for Last FM, but you should get to make sure your music is heard by as many people as possible. And if it's not on streaming services, how do we get data to these other services? Is signing up for CD Baby, making sure you're in the system.
Yeah.
A lot of bands don't get in the system. And that's hard because you're like, I don't make enough money from these services. They suck at making me money, right? But we're trying to really address that by making sure that we are, and we're a discovery service more than a replacement service. You don't go to Last FM to listen to Lady Gaga 57,000 times. You go to hear new music. And so we try to say, here's what they're playing, here's what they're selling, here's where you buy them. This is all really important to us. And I know, you know, Mog's got the ability to do that as well. We all want you to see live gigs, and we want you to support these artists offline as well.
And you know, it's also important to think about sort of how you optimize the discovery process from a streaming perspective and from a sales perspective. I think Ty was talking about that earlier. There's a total
difference between, I mean, what Apple's challenge is they recommend something, you have to buy it. And so making a buy decision means that you need to know it's going to be good. Otherwise, you have a negative buy decision, which actually makes you not buy, like, again, for a while. And even at a dollar, this is the problem. So in that world, unfortunately, that means they have to recommend things that are more likely to be a success. They're going to stay in the safer range of recommending, you got this Eric Clapton track, and you don't have that one, you should get a new Eric Clapton track rather than a new artist that's like Eric Clapton.
Yeah.
But in the streaming service, there's no penalty for playing something new, really. You can't, you know, if the user skips too many tracks in a row, they're having a bad experience. But if you throw it in there and it wins, you know, and people like it, that's great. And it didn't cost them anything to find out about that new artist and take a chance on it. So it's a totally different world. And that's why I do think the streaming service is a better, obviously better exploration for new artists than necessarily sales environment where it's tough pickings in the sales business.
A point that we haven't touched upon yet is like, how do you judge the efficiency of your recommendations? What are the data sets that you look at to find out whether the recommendation you provided was successful or not?
Well, from the music service perspective, we're looking at what people are clicking on when we display it to them. So we look for success loops, feedback loops, basically. And we will start deprioritizing things that they're not clicking on. And it's difficult because we can't predict what mood a person's going to be in, and so or any other of a million other factors. But what we really try to do is bring a mixture of something that's familiar and something that's new, and we're constantly fine-tuning how far we'll put those parameters for that particular user.
Yeah, and Paul, do you ingest any of the data on how the recommendations are doing into the services as well as a part of?
Yeah, so for evaluation, one of our primary products is playlisting, and so we spend a lot of time looking at playlists, and a playlist evaluation is kind of hard. One of the first things we do is what we call the WTF test, where we'll generate playlists and we'll look for just bad stuff. And that's a human check. And once we do that, we actually do some things like when we're doing sort of algorithm design, we'll do A/B tests where we'll have playlists that were created by professional DJs, and we'll have sort of a bake-off and look at playlists created by our playlist generators and see if people can tell the difference in which ones that they like best. But then once we go into a deployed situation, the main metric is skips and user play time. So the longer someone is listening to a particular radio station that we're generating, the better. So that's our main success metric.
Lately, we released a product for Spotify on their launch for that's now essentially a playlist generator and a recommendation tool within Spotify personalizes it. And we looked at exactly some of the same things. As those things come back and as people react to those, and we have a pretty good sense of how often people are creating those playlists. One of my favorite undocumented features, you just drag any track from Spotify onto the Last FM icon and it pulls back a playlist. And we're seeing how frequently those are going to be shared, and we're working with Spotify to make sure that those shares and how good a playlist is, and you can see this now as people starting to share playlists, how shared is something, right? And how fast is it spread is a good way of telling if it's being successful or not.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because the playlist, because it's possible now to do cross-service playlist sharing, although there's still some challenges internationally.
Yeah.
The data isn't actually, there are mistakes and problems when you go internationally, much as you were bringing up with those band names. But the reality is that that's been a fantastic thing, because before you just didn't know what services people had or even they had the tracks. And so this has made that all possible.
It's kind of a holy grail for all of us, right? Maybe not for Mog. They want you to stay on Mog. But I think we would all like to see the ability to take our playlist. If you have a friend who's not on Mog, or if you're not in someplace else, to be able to share music. We all do that thing where we share on YouTube, right?
So it's one of the number one things that the automotive guys want is playlists for drives. They want to be able to have you say, I'm going to Yosemite, and it'll automatically load up maybe a classical music version of that, and some other guys posted a jazz version of that and a rock version of that, and you can listen to what other people have programmed for you while you go. And I think that location, that's again coming back to location, but that kind of experience that's the kind of stuff that get people to use these services is new ideas like that.
And one of the things that's changed so much in the last couple of years is also the fact that companies are finally realizing that guys like Last.fm and the Echonest and Grace know that you have data that you don't need to resource once again. So, up to like 3-4 years ago, companies that were coming into the streaming world or other sort of music companies were looking at building their own systems for recommendations. And they, it's incredibly expensive and usually quite crappy. And finally, you're looking at big companies like, Vivo just did a partnership with the Echonest. It was announced last week. So big companies that are looking at guys like you to power the recommendation instead of building out their own backend.
Yeah, and we make it available in the API. I mean, Paul's got some great services for developers, and they have a really super production. We also let people hack on our API as well, and we Share My Playlist uses quite a lot of Last.fm data in its tools. We've always made that open because we think that actually makes our data set better.
Yeah, and for Last.fm, it's kind of like it's coming of age in the sense that they've had an open API policy for a number of years now, and it's only like in the last year or 2 years that really that's coming to fruition in the sense that that's reaching like mainstream consumers in a big way.
I think Last.fm really and RJ and the RDS Grobbler, they really set the standard early on that you should open up your data in APIs. And I think all of these music tech companies have followed suit to Last.fm. So I applaud Last.fm for doing such an awesome thing for the music industry with your APIs.
The other thing that's been new is that application platform on top of the music services.
Absolutely.
And that lets the small developers who were all here a few days ago do stuff on top of these services. Yeah. It is very hard to go out and actually assemble a license catalog or build a large user base, but a lot of these guys have interesting ideas, there's a guy I saw had an app that's playlist by haircut. You can pick the haircut of the kind of band that you like, and then it picks songs. It's kind of cool. And so the reality is that's something the little guy can do inside of one of these services.
Cool. We'll have 10 minutes. Questions?
Hi. Jeff?
Yep.
Well, I've seen you've been collaborating a lot, and I believe that there'll be a point that you master pretty much everything about recommendations and discovery. So, and this might become a commodity between pretty much all the online streaming platforms. So what do you think will be the next step after discovery and recommendations?
It's experience. We aren't really making experience yet. We're helping you find bands. But when it gets visual and when you can have a community experience with everyone and it's something you live, we're not there yet. We're clicking on little buttons on the screen. So I do think that next, and I don't believe that we're going to reach the end of discovery. This guy's got, 40,000 ideas that he still has to try, and so a lot of us, the rest of us. So I do think it's, it can always get better. And also just the international aspects of it. I can't spend enough time on, native music of different countries, but there are people there who are going to use these services in the future, and they're going to want that to work. And so I do feel like there's the basic concepts, and then there's all these specific cases in certain regions. It's going to be a long time before this is ever really there.
And there's... I agree. Discovery will never be solved. But we have at Chronos, we have two customers. One is eMusic, which is, you know, a very indie focused label. We also have Clear Channel, which owns 80% of the terrestrial radios. If we made a single playlister for both of those, both would go crazy because the Clear Channel listener is, you know, the mean time between Katy Perry is the primary metric there, right? Whereas on eMusic, if you play Katy Perry at all, you know, they throw you off. So for the near term, you know, in the next few years, I think everybody is going to in this space is going to want to have their own view of discovery. So, you know, Mog's vision is the one-button discovery. I think there's going to be other tools like Kite Machine or Last.fm that are going to be much more targeted for the hardcore enthusiasts who don't mind digging in and turning lots of knobs. And I think, as Ty says, things like visualizations are going to be really important. And I think back to the hacker community, there's a whole lot of really creative stuff coming out of there that's just amazing. You know, so.
Well, TJ mentioned also taste profiles. I mean, so these services today are usually mono person. But we all go to parties, and what's not existent yet is a very good party system. You know, Mog could probably build this pretty quickly, but basically, when I'm in the room, this is what it starts out with all the songs, but then when the people arrive, their phone tells you what songs they like, and that gets mixed in, and things get added and deleted, and before you know it, you got 30 people in there, and the music's really super interesting. And yeah. Those kind of multi-person experiences are also neat work, and so I think that's going to be an exciting area for the future.
There was a question at the back there.
Hi, I run a music discovery service for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, and it's just a question on tags and that multiple tag thing. I mean, we've got, you know, we cover the entire country, and you know, different people from different locations tag things differently, and it is a big thing, and it's really important that they're allowed to, so that their communities discover what they're used to calling it. But what I want to know is how you manage that internally, and I guess the role of curator, or is it all done by algorithms, or, you know, just, yeah.
So, the nice thing about Last.fm is we've got a statistically significant number of people doing this, so it helps to filter that stuff out, and it's hard when you're starting off to do that. So I suggest you rip us off. I suggest you use our API to tag and pull stuff in and use the advantage from us, or talk to Paul and work with some of the things they can do on machine tagging as well. And just, I think you need to do some of that kind of work to help boost it. You have what recommendation people all call the cold start problem. Like, where do you start when you get zero, right? You have to build that community up. So you need to do what great artists do and steal and borrow from other people.
And there are some mathematical techniques. If you have people who are calling this artist female vocalists and somebody else is saying, you know, girl singers, there are some, you know, these latent semantic indexing kind of things that will help move up to more of a semantic level, so that those tags would essentially work equivalently.
We do. We actually try to. Yeah, I think one of the things I want to do is get better at that. I mean, our tools right now, and it's, you know, I like what TJ said earlier. You know, you don't want anyone to actually have to type anything, because we're all going to stop typing soon, right? I mean, from our phone to the devices, you're going to speak it or you're going to say it, and we're all going to either by our thumbs are going to evolve differently because we're all on our phones this way, or we're going to. But I just think typing is the last thing anyone wants to do.
But there is a downside to suggesting tags. If you suggest tags, then you're making a funnel, and people are much more likely to pick a tag that's already there than do a new one. So you throw away some of the richness, and you get these little feedback things where you get the tag vandalism, I think, starts with somebody making a funny tag. You know, Dora the Explorer is tagged brutal death metal.
Exactly.
And then people latch on to that, and pretty soon every kid's playlist sounds like something the kid should never hear.
Yeah, I think that's also why the difference between personal tags and a group set of group tags is also something we do, and we let people have that personal tagging mechanism. But that's pretty sophisticated. And I think if you're trying to use tags in a fairly lightweight system, it's hard to do it on your own, is my point, right? So,
sorry.
Yes. But do you guys have editors and curators for tags?
We use our community, but you guys use...
We have 140.
Yeah.
And there's another one there.
First, I want to thank you guys for being here. I think all your companies are incredibly innovative, and I just really appreciate this panel. I want to give a little background to my question first. So I'm in an MBA program here in town in digital media, and we had a class where we created a new venture, and our new venture was focused on a music discovery engine. And at the end of the class, we present our pitch to a group of venture capitalists, and they're all legitimate venture capitalists here in town. And we thought we'd get lambasted, you know, for our business plan, for all down the road. But conceptually, we got thrown back in our face that music discovery is not important to the casual music fan. And that Pandora, which I won't go down that road, but that they have sufficiently solved that niche in the market. And our platform, it uses Echoness and specifically Echo Print to create. So just... I desperately want to use your services, but how do I convince people to give me money to develop such a platform?
Well, we all build businesses around this stuff, and so what I would say is it is actually hard to have a business that just does peer recommendation as a business. All of us have a variety of services we actually do, wherever this kind of fits into the stuff that we do as well. And so so the reality is it may be that that's actually what the – it's not that it's been solved. It's just that as a standalone single product, it's better if it's combined with other services and other things. These guys have a user base and consumer service. They have a consumer service. These guys have all kinds of services.
Yeah, people say, you know, recommendation is not a product, it's a feature. But it's a feature that it's a $100 million feature for Pandora, and it's there are a lot of companies that are paying a lot of money for that feature. So if you're not Pandora, you need that feature if you're in the music business. So
even Pandora needs to keep improving what they've done.
And they're after a different thing, I think. I think it's all to remember that they're after the basic radio business, which is a fantastic business. We're part of CBS, and CBS has a very, very big radio business. I mean, it's not a small thing. And I actually don't view Last FM as competing with Pandora at all, because I think that they're much more after the local market and the local advertising thing, which is a very different kind of a business plan than just discovery. But if you ask people where the discover music, and we talk a lot to our consumers, the radio is still the place people say they discover music. And it's just more than 60% of the people in the who discover music discover it through radio. Now, does that mean it's very wide? Is it solving a problem? I think you need to go back and talk about the business model conversation rather than the feature, as Paul says.
Yeah. Cool. I think we need to wrap it up. Well, thanks a lot for coming, and thanks, guys, for my panelists. It's great.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks.
Is that
right?
Yeah,
that's
good.
Hi.
Hi, I'm Matthew.
If you want to ask us questions, please ask them outside, because there's another panel coming.